Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
HRN has a brand new look, but we're sharing the same delicious stories. Invest in the future of food radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today I'm talking about one of my favorite topics, and that's olive oil. Now, we know archaeologists' studies and writings of historians that olive oil has been around since 600 BC at least, but it really remained until maybe the mid-20th century that it became a worldwide used, known, and desired product. So today we're going to find out more about that and why. Because my guest is Carl Ibsen, who wrote the monograph From Cloth Oil to Extra Virgin Oil, Italian Oil Before the Invention of the Mediterranean Diet. And I came across this paper because at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery just this past week, the Sophie Coe Prize Award was announced. And the Sophie Coe Prize is a long-running and generous prize for writing in food history in the English language, given once a year for an essay or article of up to 10,000 words on any aspect of the history of food. And the winner was announced at the Oxford Symposium. And who should that winner be but my guest today? And that's how I ran across this, Carl Ibsen. Carl gave a wonderful thank you announcement video for this earth-shaking news, which in fact the earth did shake. And there, he experienced a little bit of wherever he is out there in California, he experienced a little earthquake. And that was rather exciting for the whole thing. Carl is an historian of modern Italy at Indiana University. He's been a member of the faculty there since 1994, and he's also the founder and director of the IU Food Institute, which promotes faculty and graduate research in food studies. And now it offers a certificate in food studies for undergraduates. As one gathers from his publications, Carl has spent a good amount of time in Italy. His recent writings include Fumo, Italy's Love Affair with the Cigarette, which I can't wait to read, I have to say, and Italy in the Age of Pinocchio, Children and Danger in the Liberal Era. Welcome, Carl.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
It was exciting to hear your acceptance of this award, and prestigious award, and congratulations to you on that. With the earthquake in the background, I have to say that made it very exciting.
Yeah, that was carefully planned, of course. You know, uh-huh. I'm a native Californian, so I know ahead of time when these things are going to happen.
Right. Well, I gathered that you were a native Californian. All your undergraduate, graduate, and your PhD studies were all done at Berkeley, correct?
Yes, and also from kindergarten through high school.
Okay. You didn't go far afield until all of a sudden you ended up in Italy for so much time. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Well, and that was my question with all these other studies, because you have, you know, the history of modern Italy, obviously being your major topic. But you have done, you got another master's in demography, and we say demography or do we say demography? We say
demography, say I think is
demography.
Is
that's how I say demography. So, so you're pretty much writing a variety of pieces. What attracted you to writing about olive oil?
Well, it started a few years ago with the idea for the Food Institute. I mean, I had, as you mentioned, some of my publications, and that there's an earlier one still on population studies and population policy in Italy. So I've always been an Italian historian. I haven't always been involved in food studies, but I've been all my life involved in sort of the food world, if you will. I worked in restaurants in the Bay Area and have contacts there, and with producers, including a dear friend who's, in fact, an olive oil producer in California. And a few years ago, and here, well, I guess I'll start name dropping. I was at the American Academy on a visit. I'm a fellow there. I spent a fellowship year there a couple of decades ago. And I was chatting with, of all people, Alice Waters about food studies initiatives. And we got around to the topic of creating a food institute, and I thought, well, I could do something like that at IU. So when I came back from that trip, which was also a research trip, I familiarized myself with the existing food studies scholars on campus and got involved in that area. First, as just to say, as an activist would be an exaggeration, but I was interested in interacting with undergraduates and raising awareness about issues related to food and environment and so on, sustainability, equity, and these sorts of things. And so I did that and then came to the conclusion that, well, if I'm going to be in this world, I better find a topic, a research topic as well. And so I'd finished up the book on smoking, which was great fun. And I was looking around at various possibilities. I read through a series of women's magazines from the early 20th century, Italian women's magazines, which obviously focus a lot on cuisine. I thought about looking at military diet as a sort of index of sort of national ideas of what diet might be. But it came around to olive oil, and that was, you know, more intriguing still. And as I mentioned, I had some connections already in that world. And so began the research on this topic, which has been great. It's pushed me a little bit. It's taken me out of my sort of comfort zone, which is Italy after unification in 1860. And I've actually, as you know, gone back to the 18th century.
Right.
And I'm starting to look at other parts of the world because it's a global story. Italy is in some sense at the center of it, especially historically. But I've got to take into account Spanish production and consumption, obviously, in many other places as well. And I've also been looking at the contemporary world. I've spent a fair amount of time now in Puglia, the heel of the boot. It's an area that I focus on in the article that you read.
Which is food-wise is really hot right now too.
Right, right. And I published another article last year, I guess, in Gastronomica on the current situation, the really tragic olive oil situation in Puglia because of the Xylella blight that has destroyed the groves in the southern part of the peninsula. So that's a long answer to your question.
So, yeah, no, that's great. I mean, and it just throws us, you know, headlong into the whole topic of olive oil, too, in its background. I mean, to back up, go even further than the 17th, 18th centuries, you begin this paper, which is a wonderful paper, and unfortunately I've only had a chance to read through it once, and I plan to revisit that a little again. And it kind of put everything in perspective for me as far as this almost recent history of olive oil, very recent in terms of, you know, so much of what we consider standard product. And that is the concept of food mobilities. And Well, let's back up and talk a little bit about the background and the original, the origins of olive oil, that being, you know, the Middle East and Mediterranean region. Can you just bring us back there a little bit, and then we can
Fast forward? I'll comment a little on the food mobilities angle. The paper is going to appear in a volume published by the University of Toronto Press called Food Mobilities. It's edited by Simone Cinotto and Dan Bender. And so there, too, I was, you know, it wasn't necessarily my idea to choose that sort of theoretical angle, but it's a fruitful one and really interesting. So that also was new to me, in the way that this has been a eye-opening project. So we know that the oleaster plant originated somewhere probably in the Middle East, and was selected by early agriculturalists, probably going back thousands of years before the Common Era, to produce, you know, the European, what became called the European olive, and so an oil-producing plant, and that spread throughout the Mediterranean, and different cultivars were selected. I've been learning a lot about agriculture in recent years, and I would be embarrassed to say that it was only a couple of years ago that a farmer pointed out to me that apples aren't grown from apple seeds. Apple trees aren't grown from apple seeds, but from cuttings from apples that have the characteristics that one wants. And that's the same with olives. So this selection process went on for thousands of years. And so we get this amazing variety of cultivars throughout the Mediterranean, which is, of course, the homeland of the olive. And then we get into sort of recorded history and learn something about oil production in Greek times and more. Most of what I've read, and this is not obviously the focus of my research, but just feeling the need to stay up on it, also because I'm going to be teaching a course on the history of olive oil fairly soon. The Roman world was a huge consumer, and Rome was a huge consumer of olive oil. And there, too, the mobility aspect is really fascinating, because while olives grow beautifully in Italy, and of course do to this day, the Romans themselves got most of their oil from elsewhere, from Spain, from Tunisia, and from Libya. And that's also a really fascinating history. We probably know more about oil production in those places than we do about oil production in Italy. In the Roman period, although I have read some interesting archaeological pieces based on aerial photographs taken after World War I that do show evidence of where the groves existed in Puglia, in northern Puglia, actually in Foggia is where they found this evidence back in that era. But there's not much documentary evidence about oil production in Puglia, for example, in the Roman times. That, as I say, becomes really important, I think, in the 18th century, which is why I start then.
Right. And I find that even though, yes, there was some private production here, spotty here and there, and in special properties with the owner having a few trees. And I'm talking about going up to Tuscany, there's evidence of some of their vineyards having been around for, 13, 15 generations would take us back a ways. But nothing as far as the major production scale. But then again, as you point out, the oil was not really for consumption, correct?
The majority of oil produced through the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century, was not food oil. It was used for soap production, for lighting, and from my point of view, perhaps most interesting, wool production, for lubricating the yarn in wool production.
Hence your title, the cloth oil, right?
Right. Yeah, it was referred to in Britain in particular as cloth oil. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the most the most important source for that cloth oil was in fact southern Italy, to the point that it's referred to in British sources that I've been consulting since I wrote the article that you read, as Gallipoli oil. In fact, Gallipoli oil is really just another name for olive oil, whether or not it comes from Gallipoli, which is not the Gallipoli in Turkey, but the small port in Puglia on the Ionian Sea, from whence most of that oil was exported.
Interesting. I had always assumed that wool had so much lanolin in it, natural lanolin, that, you know, extra oil was not necessary, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, apparently in the scouring process, I guess, I mean, I'm no expert on this. I've talked to some people who work with wool and read a little bit, but I gather that in the scouring process, to get rid of the dirt and the smell, it loses its natural fat, which is not an issue, I think, for some artisanal producers, but for the industrial production, it was.
Right. Well, so you really do talk a lot about the production or the growth of the olives and the groves, and focused on where they grew, and referring to the Kingdom of Naples. Can you describe that for us, please?
Sure. The Kingdom of Naples was the kingdom that existed in southern Italy for how long? I don't know, 1,000 years? It was a well-established political entity in Europe for all of early modern and into the late modern period. And it consists of the Italian peninsula south of Rome, basically. Naples was the capital. Palermo in Sicily was the sort of second capital. Sicily was part of the kingdom. And that was the major producer of oil in the world in the 18th century. This changes when Spanish production increases in the 19th. And indeed, to this day, the southern regions, and this is surprises some people, including some Tuscan friends of mine, the southern regions produce the vast majority of Italian oil. Calabria, Sicily, and Puglia account for something like 75 to 80% of Italian oil.
Yeah, I knew that it was very, very high in the production scale, but I didn't realize it produced that large of a percentage of the Italian oil.
Yeah, I think that the Tuscan percentage these days is around 6 or 7%. And yet that, of course, is the oil that's best known.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting story in and of itself.
Yeah, yes. Now we're talking, as you say, the Kingdom of Naples, you referred to your original studies as being, post-unification of Italy. So this is all pre-unification.
This is all pre-unification, right. Yeah. The Kingdom of Naples, which after the Napoleonic period becomes the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, ceases to exist after 1860 with the unification. Mm. Something that the historians have long seen as sort of progress. One British politician referred to the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies as the negation of God. At the time, but there's been a lot of revisionist work since, and there are those who think that that the South got a raw deal in unification, and some are now looking back nostalgically at that kingdom, which had a lot going for it, frankly. It had a really vibrant economy, which involved not just oil, but silk and wool and wheat and citrus, that was compromised by unification, we might say.
Kind of puzzling too at that time to see where we are today, but which was more important to them, fuel or food, as far as this oil was concerned?
Yeah, that's a question I haven't been able to sort out. I think probably about equally. There was a huge administration set up to be sure that the capital city, Naples, was supplied with oil. As I mentioned, for fear that if there should be a shortage or if the price should be too high, there might be a popular insurrection. That's how important oil was. Mm-hmm. And there are references to its use as food and to its use for lighting. And I think that that for the people, if you will, for the vast majority of the population, they were using it for both. And they were using the same oil, the same quality oil for eating and for lighting, which by modern standards was not particularly good.
No.
high acidity and so on.
So then why was the 18th century so important? What occurred that made the 18th century so important?
What happens in the 18th century is the Industrial Revolution and a huge increase in demand for that that industrial oil, the Gallipoli oil that the Brits needed to for their wool manufacture, which was of course the first step in that phase of economic development, and that continues throughout the 19th century. Now, eventually, and it's interesting, I've been reading some of these earlier, again, since the article, British parliamentary papers and investigations and talking with wool manufacturers and why, you know, Gallipoli oil is better than anything else. And it is. They have rapeseed oil, but they don't use that for, they use that for low quality wool. For the high quality wool, they insist on olive oil. They've tried to use whale oil. But that is a problem because if they leave it to sit overnight, it combusts spontaneously. And they've had factories burned down because they've tried to use whale oil. So into the 19th century, it's a really important product. And the demand is high and the price correspondingly higher than for other oils. The part that I maybe haven't completely sorted out yet is how they developed seed oils, which they do, that that come to be a better product than olive oil and come to replace olive oil in the production process. Now, seed oils are industrially manufactured and a lot cheaper. So eventually they take over. And in the 20th century, we see the transition from, you know, the dominance of industrial oil to most olive oil becoming comestible oil or food oil. And so new requirements or needs with regard to quality.
Yeah. I mean, so from the 18th century on into probably the early or the turn of the 20th century. I mean, that was this Kingdom of Naples. This is their most important item of foreign trade, as you point out. I mean, this was huge.
Right. Certainly in the 18th and the early 19th century, citrus in the 19th century becomes more important. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the century, citrus is a more important product. Which interestingly is apparently the first area infiltrated by the mafia following unification in Sicily. But that's another story.
We'll get to that when we start talking about fraud and right. Adulteration of oil. I did a couple shows on that, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins has been on a couple times, both with her Mediterranean diet and the oil industry. And these are problems that go on still to this day.
But, they do.
We initially started out with the theory of food mobilities. And of course, because these trees couldn't exist elsewhere, except they do exist in California. So you're no stranger to olive trees there. But because it originated in the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and couldn't really thrive anywhere else. When did the North begin to request some of the comestible oil, the noble extract, as they referred to it?
Right,
when,
right.
About when did that occur?
Well, I found references from the late 18th century by Italian producers saying that some of the English are starting to use it as food. I haven't found any evidence of that yet in British sources. I did find a British source which said they thought like some Belgians maybe used it for food. This in the 19th century.
Yeah, and not even the north of Italy. I mean,
Sure. Yeah, I mean, as I point out, you know, prior to 1960 or so, and that's when this article ends. I'm obviously going to continue working on the period afterwards. It's fascinating. olive oil was not consume much in northern Italy, in places like Milan, except by southern immigrants who were, you know, after World War II started moving to places like Turin and Milan for work, and so brought their foodways with them. Similarly, I mean, you mentioned the California trees. You know, olive oil is a Mediterranean product, and obviously not just Italy, but throughout the Middle East and North Africa and Spain and southern France and so on. But it's with the Mediterranean diaspora, we might say, of which the Italian was the largest component, that demand for olive oil spreads to places like the United States and Argentina and Australia, South Africa, and so on. and indeed some of those migrants, primarily Italians, but not only, start to cultivate olives in places like California. So there are some, you know, how you've seen the ancient gnarled trees in Puglia that we don't see anywhere else in the world that the locals claim are 1,000 years old. They're almost certainly at least 500 years old. We don't see those in California, but I have seen some trees that probably are 100 years old. And those initially mostly were for table olives. And there's some interesting studies from agronomists in California on that. And then in the recent decades, we see the growth of the really high quality olive oils being produced in California, but also in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and so on.
Right, right. And as you say, you just sort of you look at the Italian diaspora and you follow the growth of the olive trees, olive oils. California in itself, it would be an interesting study, I think, as far as the history of the olive oil industry there. But back to Italy, of course. See, I think you say olive oil to somebody and most people probably respond with Italian olive oil, Italy, you know, olive oil, Italy. Whereas you said so much of the oil originally came from, for the Italians themselves, you know, from Spain, Libya, Greece, even, you know, other places. It's interesting that they, and then the Industrial Revolution comes along and ups the game a bit. But there were problems with the purity of the oil when after the Industrial Revolution. And we're going to talk, I want to talk a little bit more about that and get into the more modern era, but we're going to take just a brief sponsor break here and we'll be right back with more. So stay tuned.
Did you know that Heritage Radio Network, or HRN, and all its 40 different podcasts, including my show, A Taste of the Past, run on listener support? That's right. It's been 11 years since HRN started broadcasting food radio, and we've made it that far thanks to listeners like you who support our efforts to bring you the best in food podcasts. Your contributions have kept us on the airwaves all these years, even during the pandemic. I'm Linda Palacio, and I want to share some exciting news with you. HRN has a new look, a new brand identity, and a new website. The new site makes it easier than ever to discover new podcasts and dig through the archive of over 16,000 episodes. You can count on us to bring you new content each week, and we hope that we can count on you to keep it going by becoming a member of HRN. Why not set up a monthly recurring donation of any amount, $1, $5, or $10, on up, and choose a favorite show, like A Taste of the Past, in the designation drop-down menu. Become a monthly sustaining member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
We are back. And Carl, I wanted to kind of fast forward into post-industrial revolution and what was happening with olive oil.
Right, right. Well, let me follow up on some of your comments before the break and give you my my sort of current take on this situation. So we had a world of olive oil, and again, looking at southern Italy in the 18th century, where maybe 1% of the oil was good quality food oil, and maybe 20% was food oil at all. And then, with the decline of demand in the late 19th century and early 20th century for industrial oil, whether for lighting or wool or, well, it's still used for soap. Here is all this oil, and what do we do with it? I think is the conundrum that faced the producers. And they could increase the percentage of good oil, but not that much because the technology was slow. I mean, you know that, but perhaps it's worth mentioning that olives are carried from the trees, carried from the groves to the mill where they're crushed, which could take an hour or more per batch. And then the crushed olives are transferred to rush discs, which are stacked and pressed, and that takes hours and hours. the first oil that comes out is good, and the next oil that comes out is less good, and then they press it some more and add hot water, and you get the poorest quality oil. And then as far as the olives to start with, the best quality oil, and today the really only acceptable way to make oil, is by picking the olives freshly off the trees at the right moment, usually in the fall, October, November. Historically, olives were gathered off the ground. They waited for them to fall off the trees. And they were, today, extra virgin olive oil needs to be pressed within 24 hours of that picking. Historically, the olives might sit in vats for days, weeks, or even months before they get pressed. You know, that's the 80% or 90% of oil that was produced that really was not, that was good for industrial purposes, but was not really very good to eat. Although probably the poor in southern Italy consumed some very low quality oil. Mm-hmm. So what to do with all of that oil that for which there's no longer much demand? Well, you know, as I say, they started to speed up the technology and improve the technology with mechanization and steam power and so on. But they also developed other methods, in particular purification or refining of the oil, which was a chemical process which could bring down the acidity and make it, which is the main issue, was the high acidity of these oils, and make it comestible. So they started to sell that as food oil, usually blended with a percentage of, you know, better quality oil, say 10%. Olio fino, or what would become to be called virgin oil, with the refined oil, which seems like a reasonable strategy, and given the technology of the day, was. But of course, there was a lot of confusion on the part of the consumers, and a failure to distinguish between, you know, high quality oils and these other blended oils. And olive oil was also blended with cottonseed oil and other seed oils, and sold often as if it were pure olive oil, although of course it wasn't. So the seeds of that fraud, which, as you mentioned, continue to this day, are planted in the 19th century, part out of necessity. I mean, you know, that was the only way to make to manage that quantity of oil with the technology that they had. Mm-hmm. The wonderful thing about the modern era, and you know, anyone who's nostalgic about those old presses, well, they're in a small minority. the oil they produced was not very good. Since the 1960s, they've developed technologies that can process much larger quantities of oil much faster with lower levels of oxidation. And oxygen is, of course, one of the biggest threats to the quality of olive oil. And so we can produce much larger quantities of good oil, of what now we call extra virgin oil, since 1960. Nonetheless, of course, the issues of blending and refining and mislabeling continue. While I was in Puglia interviewing for the piece I wrote about Zilela, there was yet another scandal. They found a place that for 20 years had been selling seed oil treated with chlorophyll as extra virgin olive oil, you know, shipping it out of northern Puglia to Germany and getting away with it.
It's supply and demand and you know, profit at the end that is going to lead the industry to all kinds of problems. But it, if anyone has ever been to a mill where, you know, olives are being pressed, the first pressing is, and tasted that oil, it's a taste that, well, to say, you taste that once and you'll never go back, you know, to anything else. It's really quite remarkable. And a lot of people, and I have several friends who have small properties, but they gather their olives very carefully, you know, from the trees, as you said, and not letting them wait till they drop to the ground. But the problem for them is, you know, it's just a small amount, but they want to have them pressed into oil, and then they have to take them to the community mill. And it's just, sometimes then they'll sit there for another week in line with it because they have to wait for their turn for their olives to be pressed. And then their olives might be thrown in with, you know, some neighboring olive somewhere. And so they're really not getting, you know, the quality that they want. And it's a problem. So the industry has tried to sort that out, as you as you say, they've sped things up and made it better. Mm-hmm, small mm-hmm. producers still have those problems, though. Very small producers.
Sure, they do. And the so-called, you know, hobby producers who right. just grow their own olives and have to use a local mill, you know, they sort of the luck of the draw, as you point out, for getting it pressed quickly. Obviously, the people who are most concerned with producing a high quality and so more expensive oil have their own mills and control every phase of the procedure. You know, you mentioned the issue of Spanish oil in Italy and the food mobility. I'd like to go back to that for just a second, because sure. one of the other oddities, if you will, of this history is that Italy, again, in the 19th century, becomes a major importer of oil, which it continues to be to this day. Most of it Spanish oil, because again, the Spanish production has now eclipsed Italian by a factor of 2, 3, or 4. Whereas, you know, 150 years ago, Italy was producing more oil than Spain. But you know, one problem with olive production is that the tree is alternate bearing. It would like to produce a crop just every 2 years. Mm. If you prune it properly and irrigate and perhaps fertilize, you can get a crop every year, but it varies dramatically. And so if you look at olive oil statistics, you'll see that the production varies a lot from year to year. So there's some years that Italy maybe needed to import oil just for domestic consumption. But in fact, what's happening to a lot of that oil is it's being rebottled as Italian oil. Now, the labeling laws today are strict in Europe, but an Italian name is an Italian name. And even if you look in the fine print, you see that the oil in the bottle comes from Spain, Tunisia, and Greece, as well as Italy. But most people probably don't read that label. So you've got this industry of importing lots of oil into Italy, some of which, of course, gets refined. And here we get into issues of fraudulent labeling. But others is, you know, you buy extra virgin olive oil from Spain and put it in Italian bottles and export it to the United States. And, you know, that satisfies a certain consumer demand. It's a little bit perverse, but that's why Italy is today the biggest importer of oil in the world.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's an interesting, you know, route to follow and where, you know, where mm-hmm. all the oil comes from. And yes, I was aware of much of that, but it's interesting that the oil industry, as opposed to, let's say, the wine industry and some cheeses and other things, that there's no DOC designation. They have other laws and designations, but you know, because of this, I would imagine, because they have to get their olives from elsewhere and the oil from elsewhere, that there's no.
Well, there is now the DOC equivalent.
There's a designation.
For oil. There have been there's a lot of, and I don't have the number at hand. I have looked at this. There are many small areas. Puglia, for example, has 5 different designations, geographic designations. More recent, and for Puglia, they haven't added much value. So the growers are not very impressed with that. More recently, they've added, and I need to go back and check the initials, and I'm always confused because sometimes I've got them in English and sometimes I've got them in Italian. But the there is now, I think it's the DOP. No, the DOP is the one I was just describing. There's another appellation, which they now have for Tuscany. There's an Tuscan oil label, there's a Puglian oil label, there's a Sicilian oil label, which covers the whole region. And those are a little less rigid in terms of the requirements. And those maybe are going to be commercially more interesting. And one of the problems with the DOP in Puglia was that I met one grower who had his, you know, groves in one DOP and his mill in another, so he couldn't use either. There's some of these sorts of problems, but yeah. The new labeling, if they do it well, and I think there's reason to believe that they will, the Olio di Puglia and the Olio di Sicilia and the Olio di Toscana, those are labels, you know, those are names that people will recognize, you know, Terre di Bari, less so.
When exactly did the, classification of extra virgin or virgin olive oil, the extra virgin olive oil?
Okay, well, the virgin term starts to have legal significance in the 1930s. That's a oil classification. But extra virgin is the 1960 law. And that's the law that everyone looks back to today as making a real difference. That was the first law that specified that extra virgin oil would be only made by mechanical processes, so no chemicals, no industrial production, that the, you know, olives would be milled within 24 hours of harvesting, that the acidity would, I think the initial level was 1.2%, but now it's down to 1% or even below that maximum. And of course, the best oils are well below that. That was sort of the beginning of the modern era of olive oil. And that's where we get this strange term of extra virgin that I explore a little bit in the piece. And since then, it was a propitious moment because that's when the new technologies came online. So it became possible to produce. The estimate that I encountered was that in 1960, about 20% of the oil produced in Italy was virgin, not extra virgin, so higher levels of acidity. And extra virgin was less than that, so you know, maybe 5%. Now, if you look at the supermarket shelf today, it looks like 100% of oil is extra virgin. Now, that's also a problem, I think.
Yeah, labeling
but certainly the amounts of good quality oil that are made today are far higher than they were 70 years ago. Or 60 years ago. Let's say 60 years ago when the law was passed.
Well, I mean, it's amazing that there are so many bottles on the shelves today. I mean, I can remember a time when the selection was, you know, quite limited. When I was a kid, especially, I remember there was this one teeny tiny little bottle of, I think it was Pompeian oil or something, right? A little tiny bottle. And now look at our shelves, you know, just loaded. But then comes the problem with how do you choose and how can you trust which labels and, you know, and what are you getting? The legislation, you know, fortunately for some of the protection laws that they instituted, we can be somewhat assured that we're getting at least not chemically produced oil and just mechanically ground.
I went to a food show in Florence. It's been a few years now that had a section on olive oil, and one expert got up there and said a number of interesting things. This is an Italian who we would think would be an advocate of Italian oil. And he said, you know, the European laws are pretty good. You can pretty much believe what's on the label. And as I say, if you look carefully now, it says where the olives come from and so on. And if they come from five different places, chances are the quality is not as good as one of those DOP oils that comes from a specific region. But again, the quality of the oil will vary in terms of because of the practices of the grower and of the miller and so on. But then he said, you know, outside of Europe, it's the Wild West. No one else has laws like the European laws, and what you get in the U.S., for example, it's very hard to know what's inside that bottle when you buy a Costco olive oil. Yeah, maybe it tastes good, but maybe it is good. But it's hard to know quite exactly what's in there. I mean, you have to trust the producer. And in any case, that oil or a Trader Joe's oil or, you know, it's not going to be the highest quality oil. You can't get at that price, you can't get the kind of oils, the really beautiful oils that are being made all over the world, California, Tuscany, Puglia, Spain, you know. But they're going to be smaller production. They're going to be a lot more expensive. There's just no, you can't make a good quality oil for $10 a liter or $8 a liter.
Yeah, I mean, and when, you know, when they're rebottled in America, you get these truckloads coming, tankers, and it's rebottled in America. You got to know, you have to suspect at least that it's not the purest quality. And, you know, the old edict that, you know, you get what you pay for. I mean, yes, it's going to cost you more. And yet there, you know, food people and a good friend of mine once said, you know, forget this, that you can't fry with olive oil, you can't do this with olive oil, you can do anything with olive oil. Use, when you're cooking, just always use the best olive oil that you have for everything. I mean,
And that's wonderful if you can afford it.
If you can. And that's just the problem that it is. And then California oil, of course, because of the, you know, restrictions and the careful production, it's become even more expensive. Same with, of course, with wines, you know, compared, you know, a Californian wine to a European wine. And it's just, it's interesting. But it's amazing, as I say, how recent the history is of the olive oil that we have on our table today. I mean, it is recent.
It is. I mean, and again, not just here. One of the avenues I've been pursuing in the last couple months is I've been looking at Artusi's classic handbook of Italian cookery from the 1890s. Mm-hmm. And he mentions oil, but almost never exclusively. Oil is almost always an alternative. You can use oil, or you can use lard, or you can use butter. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the state of middle class Italian eating at the turn of the 20th century. And it would be a bit different if he were a Southerner. He's not. There's the occasional dish which insists upon olive oil. For example, a couscous menu. Now, the couscous he describes as a dish in Italy made by Jews, made by Italian Jews. So it's not surprising they don't use lard. But that's a sort of rare example that I've found so far in looking through his work. And in those Italian women's magazines that I looked at as well, Preziosa and La Cucina Italiana, if you want to call that a women's magazine, from the interwar period.
I don't know that I would call that strictly a women's magazine. But yeah, La Cucina Italiana.
But Preziosa is. And another one I looked at, the name of which is escaping me. But even there, you know, there's a heavy use of lard and butter, of animal fats, as opposed to olive oil. I mean, olive oil is there, but it isn't the prized fat that it is today. Today, any Italian cookbook that you buy, certainly in English, is going to be using olive oil in almost everything. Right. And it's, you know, for all sorts of reasons. But that transition, has taken place in this 60-year period since that the legislation, not just because of it, but it just happened to coincide with this modern era, I would call, of olive oil and its conquest of countries around the world. I mentioned in the piece, Elizabeth David in 1954 couldn't find olive oil easily in England. Right. Today, every celebrity chef in England is using olive oil.
It's a new world in terms of cooking. I mean, it's a smaller world because we share the same cooking ingredients. We have access to many of the same cooking ingredients. And I kind of think that shrinks our experiences a bit. And
the advantages and disadvantages of globalization and of those food mobilities, because you can get olive oil everywhere now, and you know they're producing olive oil in Japan and China and places you would never have imagined.
Right. It's just an exciting travel of a product to read about and to read your writing, especially with the research you've done. And I look forward to post 1960. If you promise that you're going to continue writing more, I look forward to.
Yeah, that's my plan. I'm embarking on a sabbatical year during which I'll spend a good chunk in Italy, and during which I hope to fill out the narrative, and come up with a book at the end of this period that takes us into this latter period and explore some other dimensions from the earlier periods as well.
Well, eat a lot of good food with olive oil.
Thank you.
Drink a lot of good wine, some noble extract and noble grapes, and finish it off with some noble rotten. And I wish you the best. And again, congratulations on this prize, because we need good writings in food history. And I also congratulate you on, it's long overdue because I didn't know about it, but establishing the Food Institute at the university as well. I think that's
thanks very much. I have to say that the co-award was obviously I applied for it. It seemed like a reasonable thing to do, and then I kind of forgot about it, and suddenly I get this email that I had won it. That was a great surprise and a great honor.
Terrific.
It gives me more motivation to finish off the project.
Yes, indeed. Well, I look forward to hearing more about that. So thank you so much for sharing your information. And to my listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. And remember that heritageradionetwork.org is a listener-supported network. So if you go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org, or otherwise called HRN, be sure to hit donate or become a member. And if you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe, and you'll have all of them downloaded to your phone or wherever you get your podcasts automatically. Okay? Thanks for listening. It's been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.